Matt Gaetz as Attorney General, Robert F. Kennedy as Secretary of Health, Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy as the heads of an efficiency government position. That's the cabinet or the proposed cabinet of Donald Trump. And this is the Western bubble. My name is Dario Hasenstab and I'm here with Balder Hagretz. Balder, when I talk about these names, what do they do with you? Do they feel good? Do they feel reassuring that, you know, this Trump administration is not going to be as bad as they predicted?
Yeah, Dario, good to be here again. And I was worried initially that Trump would get some lunatics into his cabinet. But now that I see these names, it's completely clear that he goes for competence and strong expertise in the areas where it matters most, obviously.
That's excellent. I'm glad we agree and we can move on to the second and third topic of this episode when we will talk about the events in Amsterdam between between supporters of football clubs. I'm going to try to say it as neutral as possible. And then later in the episode, we will move on to the situation in Israel and in Gaza. But let's move all the jokes aside about that first Trump cabinet. It is interesting to see that Trump really has no regard for even trying to come across as reasonable, right? As he did 8 years ago when the picks for cabinet seemed, right? I don't know, in me, they create this reaction of, oh, okay, it might not be that bad. These candidates seem to be very reasonable politicians. But nowadays, 8 years later, the most reasonable one seems to be Marco Rubio, and that speaks for itself.
Yes, what you see right now is that Trump is free from any internal resistance within the party, whereas in 2016, 2017, he still had to navigate a traditional political party that had concerns about his presidency. Essentially, that side of the party has been completely eliminated. You can talk about the Senate, where there's still a few of them around, but not in any powerful way. And so he's basically unshackled. He can fulfill his own desire to basically get people around him who are loyal to him, who think in his way, who will not pose any kind of problems in the next 4 years of narcissism that we're going to see. And this is interesting because in 2017 in his cabinet, there were also some military people who afterwards said, look, I went in there to try to limit the damage. I wanted to make sure that he wouldn't start pressing the wrong nuclear buttons. I wanted to make sure he wouldn't start any unnecessary wars because of his ignorance on foreign policy. And all those people are now completely gone. In fact, there are a lot of rumors, serious rumors, that within the Pentagon, there are all kinds of crisis meetings about how are we going to react if Donald Trump gives us a legal but incredibly destructive order. And that is, of course, the big problem that we face right now, that Trump is, without opposition around him, going to be able to fulfill his own agenda, however crazy it might be.
Because that's something we were sure of last week, but we didn't have the confirmation yet, is that the House of Representatives in the United States is also Republican. So the Senate is Republican and the presidency is Republican. And then there is a what they call supermajority on the Supreme Court, right, where six of the candidates are also leaning towards the Republican side, and three of them were even appointed by Donald Trump himself. So he's completely unchecked with regards to the division of powers, it feels like. And as you said, there's also no internal opposition within the Republican Party, where before there were still these very strong voices that would kind of keep him in check. And I remember Marco Rubio being one of them. And now, 8 years later, he is happy to become the Secretary of State and go full through with Trump's ideas for foreign policy.
Yes, and what is even more important, I would argue, than those big names. So those big names in themselves have a certain absurdity to them, right? If it wasn't so serious, it would be laughable to have someone like Gates leading the Justice Department, for example. The real problem is at a lower level, right? He already did this during his first presidency, but in the next 4 years, it's going to be get much worse, putting people in positions that in by themselves should not be political. people who are loyalist to Trump, thereby changing the system from within, right? Whereas in the first term, the Justice Department managed to be relatively independent despite a pressure from the White House. That independence is slowly being chiseled away at by putting more and more Trump loyalists within the sort of file and rank positions that actually decide real policymaking, that decide the real affairs of the United States government.
That is the draining of the swamp you're talking about, yeah. Right? That, I mean, it's very important for a system to function, right? This is also one of the things that why nations fail. One of those old time class. I mean, to me, it feels like a classic already for international relations. Talks about how important it is to have a strong bureaucratic body in your country, right? Because it's essential to govern effectively. So that's that swamp that Donald Trump has always talked about. That kind of kept him from going through with all of the policies in his first presidency. And as you said, now that's about to change, and about to change for good. And I remember in 2019, there was a book by Ronan Farrow that came out, basically talking about how he already did this on the foreign policy level, where a lot of the lifelong diplomats that were stationed all across the world for the United States, which made US foreign policy so effective at times, because it's really important to have these diplomats understanding the country, building relations, right? And then kind of also stabilizing foreign policy. A lot of them were kicked out and just replaced by people who were a bit more sympathetic towards Trump. And with this seriously hurting US foreign policy on a long-term and larger scale level. And that was just foreign policy 8 years ago.
There's this fascinating case of the US ambassador to the Netherlands, appointed by Trump. If I remember correctly, his name's Piet Hoekstra. He had some Dutch heritage. That's why he was that was one of the reasons why he went to the Netherlands. But he was a Republican politician who had made claims about the Netherlands being full of no-go areas where cars were burning. And the moment he became ambassador, the Dutch press asked him about it. Like, hey, why did you claim that our country is full of no-go areas where there are cars burning and where there's all kinds of crime-infested places where you are basically in danger when you go there at night? And he didn't have an answer, but the result was that no Dutch politician wanted to be seen with him because he was seen as an idiot. He was seen as a clown. And it made it very difficult for the Dutch to actually treat the American ambassador and the American embassy with any serious level negotiations or approach. And so there is a real damage that the United States does to itself by appointing these kinds of people to these places. I think that is at a foreign policy level. I think at a domestic level, it is a very slow decline and decay of the democratic system, of course.
Putting it like this, hits hard, right? It's because right before this episode, I was telling you that I've now entered basically a post-breakup phase with my feelings towards US politics, right? So now it's like in a relationship where, I don't know, someone breaks up with you and then you, right, you really liked that person before and now you hear that, oh, I don't know, their hair's falling out. And you're like, ha ha ha, you deserve it, you know. That's a little bit my state of mind towards the United States right now. Where I'm like, okay, you know what? Yeah, you deserve it that Robert F. Kennedy is now going to take vaccines away or something like this, right? So kind of on the crazy level, on the surface level. But then when you say it like this, that this is a slow but sure path to the decline of democratic institutions in the United States, that hits really hard.
Yeah, and that is the really important issue here. Much more so, I know that a lot of people, including Trump himself, by the way, are talking about a third term, right? Trump has joked about it, which is also just a sign of him not understanding his responsibilities as a president, of course. But a lot of people have this attitude of, oh, this is going to be, from now on, the United States is going to be a dictatorship. No, that's not how it typically works. Donald Trump is at some point going to leave the White House. And it's not as if the moment that he leaves the White House, he will have established a dictatorship within the United States. It's that very slow path where everything becomes a little bit less organized, good governance gets replaced by politics, and slowly over time, the system just doesn't work anymore in line with what a liberal democracy should be like. And that doesn't mean that in 2028, the United States wakes up to an authoritarian regime. It means that by 2050, one day we wake up and we don't recognize liberal democracy in any serious form anymore. It's that slow replacing of the essential parts of democracy that we need to be worried about.
Can you believe that this was the lighthearted part of today's episode? Is that in the preparation for the episode, we said, oh, let's talk about the United States first, because the other topic we want to talk about is a lot more serious, and we can't end that episode then on something lighthearted. I'm still missing the lighthearted part.
Well, I mean, okay, let's end this bit on a lighthearted note by just repeating what you just said. Kennedy, health secretary, and Gates, justice secretary. I mean, that in itself should make everyone laugh and cry at the same time.
At the same time, as you said. Then let's move on to some more, well, topics where it's more difficult to laugh about. There's more crying involved, I believe. So last week, Thursday, the Netherlands was in the news. Balder, it doesn't happen so often, I would say. I was really surprised that you had a prime minister. Not that the Netherlands doesn't have a prime minister, but that there was a new prime minister, because I feel like we talked about the elections a few months ago, and suddenly there's a prime minister that I've never heard about. But that's not the focus of what we're going to talk about. It is events that took place on Thursday night following a football game between the Dutch club of Ajax Amsterdam and the Israeli club of Maccabi Tel Aviv in a Europa League, UEFA Europa League setting. And I mean, you just asked me in a kind of preparation for this episode what my take on it was. And my summary was that, oh, on the one side, a pogrom must have happened where all of the Netherlands was chasing basically supporters of Maccabi Tel Aviv. And on the other side, it was the IDF and the Mossad who infiltrated these football fans and started causing riots, because that's the level of public discussion that we nowadays live in. That's what we're talking about. These two extremes and nothing else.
And everything is in absolutes. Everything is in a non-reasonable tone. It's all about basically either you're for or against, and if you say something that I don't agree with, then you're immoral. That is very, very clearly visible in the way that the world has dealt again with this, just like it is dealing with so many things around the world, right? And especially for me, what was particularly shocking was the simplicity, the oversimplicity, and the lack of genuine rational conversation from the media and Dutch politicians. It shows how far the Netherlands has sunk into a dark, dark place when it comes to these things. So a quick, just I think reasonable analysis is that there were different dynamics at play. The first dynamic is just the most visible one, a bunch of hooligans get attacked by locals. Those hooligans behaved aggressively, behaved violently, behaved unpleasantly, as hooligans often do. Also, Maccabi Tel Aviv has already a very bad reputation in this regard. It's a very extreme club, just like some European clubs. I think you mentioned Roma, right? Has this has this reputation. So
Lazio Roma, exactly.
Lazio, not AS. Okay. So, all right. So you're the football expert. I'm clearly not. That is the first observation. Then the second observation is they were attacked. These hooligans were attacked by locals, some of which attacks were clearly anti-Semitic, as in nature. The people were arrested. It was clear that there was anti-Semitism involved, which of course is horrible. Some of it was more related to frustration about their behavior, and some of it was related to frustration about Israeli policy in Lebanon and Gaza. So there are these different, really complex and all very unpleasant dynamics happening. And it is perfectly right that people get arrested for violent attacks. It's perfectly good to talk about anti-Semitic elements, but in the Dutch media and in Dutch politics, it became basically only about anti-Semitism rather than anything else. And there was no ability to actually get even the basic details about the events, because the moment you ask, okay, so how many people were actually seriously injured? It doesn't matter. Anti-Semitism. Okay, but what led up to these events? Doesn't matter. Anti-Semitism. And as a result, it is a huge, huge insult to the actual conversation about anti-Semitism. And it's a huge insult to the actual understanding of why violence takes place in a situation like this.
Yeah. I mean, so as someone who, right, as you just mentioned, right, I'm a football fan myself, and I've also traveled within the EU to go to European away games, right? And there, right, so it's basically like a nice quick holiday for you and your friends. You get to go to a new European city. If you're lucky, you get to go to the European South, and the sun is shining and everything is lovely, and you kind of, right, you have this in-group thinking, right? Oh, I'm here with my friends. I'm in a good mood for 3 days. I'm on vacation. There's a football game. Let's start drinking some beers at maybe 12 o'clock. And I know from looks that you received that it's not always the most pleasant appearance you have, right? Because German football fans, and they're drinking and they're loud and they're singing and they're happy about, too happy. Why are Germans happy, right? It's kind of that. So I understand this from a group dynamic perspective, right? Of these Israeli fans and supporters going to Amsterdam. I mean, it's also a trip to Amsterdam. That sounds really cool. Now we add to this that there were these hooligans from Maccabi, and as you said, they are very extreme. They also have a very clear political idea, right? They are. I think we can say they kind of closely align with what the government is doing and their actions, which was then represented in their chants, right? So because these were the provocations that you just talked about, right? They tore down Palestinian flags. They chanted some really nasty things about Gaza and about the war that I'm not going to repeat here, and it's your typical like unhealthy behavior and something that is very much in line with what we've seen from the whole of the whole of Israel, I don't want to say, but like the Israeli government and just the Israeli behavior that we've seen over the last year. And we've analyzed this in the past with the Israeli delegation to the Eurovision Song Contest, right? So that's the setting of the scene. And then you have locals respond to that, kind of, again, now grouping together, being like, oh, they are coming here to our city, they're tearing down the Palestinian flag, they're vandalizing, they're chanting things, let's get them. And that turns into then violence, right, on both sides, but also these really terrible videos of just people chasing Maccabi supporters on scooters, and beating them as they're on the floor, on the ground, that just doesn't look very good, right? But it's a clear result of group dynamics, of insider versus outsider thinking, of something that I have observed on a different level, right, with football fans happening. But the problem here is that we're talking about supporters from Maccabi Tel Aviv, right? And that they are Jewish. And then you have Dutch media and Dutch politicians, and also international media for that sake, going into a little bit of overdrive by calling it a pogrom.
Which to me, the people, and there were including the mayor of Amsterdam, used that word. I think it's such an insult to pogroms. It's such an insult to the actual reality of what happened in the Russian Empire and, of course, in Germany in 1938. And it is such an insult to what that word should actually stand for. Now, none of that demands or requires from us to take away the anti-Semitic element. Of course, there's always an anti-Semitic element when it involves Jewish people, certainly in today's world. It's always nice to use myself as basically the least oppressed person in the world, right? I tick all the boxes for someone who is not oppressed. If I get assaulted on the street by someone, then that is bad, because violence is bad. Please don't assault me. But there is no further sensitivity except a conversation about violence. When a woman is assaulted, then it is straight away there should be a conversation about sexism, patriarchy, gender violence, those kinds of things. If a African-American is assaulted by the American police, then there should be a conversation about institutional racism and those things. Similarly, if a Jewish person is assaulted, then there should straight away be an aspect of anti-Semitism to, at the very minimum, to check if it's there, right? And so I don't have a problem with the going down that route of let's analyze how much of this was anti-Semitic. That's a really important question to ask. But you cannot just act as if anti-Semitism means that no other conversation has to take place, as if there's no conversation about the behavior of the hooligans themselves, as if there's no conversation about this happening in a broader context with Israel's destructive foreign policy or domestic policy over the past year or decades. So the fact that Dutch media and Dutch politics didn't let any of that conversation take place. And whenever you try to raise something, no, anti-Semitism. Surely you don't want to deny anti-Semitism. Surely you don't want to act as if any kind of anti-Semitism is justified. That basically created an enormous taboo about rational, reasonable analysis. And it is now leading to very scary dynamics in, for example, Dutch parliament, where they're talking about taking passports away from people who commit anti-Semitic acts, which should concern you all from a constitutional perspective, right? It's leading to anti-Semitism being equated to terrorism, whereas Islamophobia or racism or sexism don't belong in that category. And that creates a completely wrong conversation that we should be having.
And into all of this, right, into that difficult public discussion between politicians and also with the media, you sent me a video of I think we can call him a blogger, and we're going to link this in the post description below, who analyzed the reporting of Sky News on that day. And it was very interesting because the immediate report coming out of Sky News was basically the reporter recounting the story that she had seen develop over the day, right? So provocations by the Maccabi hooligans, right? This was something building up over 2 days already, tensions rising, and then these actions happening. And this was a nice two and a half minute story. And then that exact same story got changed and republished basically a few hours later, and suddenly had a very different tone to this. Right, where now it was more about these Jewish fans got attacked. We need to do something about it. And then they put in basically an interview of one of the Maccabi supporters who said, this straight away brought back feelings from October 7th from 2023. Which I mean, I'm not going to talk about this man's feelings, but from a reporting perspective, that's an entirely different image, going from, these are dynamics, right? Violent dynamics that have kind of escalated over the last 2 days and now ended in this, straight away to, these are anti-Semitic attacks that occurred here and they need to be condemned. That is scary, right? Because that kind of supports everything that people who are critical of traditional media always say, is that things are being altered and we're being tricked here.
Yeah, that is scary censorship, especially, and that's important to realize, that this was from Sky News. And Sky News is not exactly an anti-Semitic entity. I mean, Sky News has been very kind of aggressively taking an Israeli line, certainly in the first couple of months after October last year. And so nobody can accuse Sky News of being somehow a biased platform in that regard. And you have then in the other way, I mean, and you've got a reporter who reports what she sees. She presents that. She presents the events as she sees it. And that reporting then gets editorialized. That reporting then becomes a narrative rather than journalistic reporting. And yes, this is exactly what's wrong with the world at the moment, that there is this sense of morality that needs to be imposed on actual journalistic reporting, right? So if you report on violence in, let's say, Gaza, then you also straight away need to give the context of terrorism happening last year, because otherwise it doesn't have the right moral tone. If you report on violence in Lebanon, you have to straight away also report that there are rockets being fired by Hezbollah against Israel, in order to editorialize the tone of everything. It takes away the whole point of journalism, right? It means that they believe that their role is to tell us a story, a narrative, rather than approximate the reality as they see it.
And this story and narrative was then kind of, well, increased or furthered by the Israeli government, right? Which goes back to this bunker mentality, because Netanyahu then sent two military planes, or wanted to send them, to the Netherlands to pick up the supporters, which really shows you, also since that Eurovision episode, how much more intense that bunker mentality in Israel has become.
Yeah, a part of it is, of course, show. I mean, Netanyahu must have known, and obviously knows, that the Netherlands wasn't a war zone. So part of it is basically feeding into that narrative of, oh, we need to rescue Israelis, Jewish people everywhere. And in this case, poor, innocent Tel Aviv supporters are being threatened by pogroms in Amsterdam. We need to send our military to get them out of there. That is, a lot of it is theater, but it shows exactly the insanity of current Israeli perspectives on how they should present themselves to the world. If you were a marketing expert, or if you like a propaganda expert, and you were hired by the Israeli government over the past year, say, what is the ideal image from a foreign policy perspective, from a security perspective, to portray to the rest of the world? How do you want Israel to be seen? Then, from a marketing perspective, what you want is Israel being the kind, warm, pleasant, innocent victims who were who were slaughtered by horrible, evil terrorists in October last year, and now are just trying to get by and trying to defend themselves. That's kind of the propaganda that you want to portray to the rest of the world. And yet, Israel, wherever they go, whether it is Israeli journalists around the world, or whether it is the Eurovision Song Contest that you mentioned before, or whether it's these supporters and then the Israeli government's reaction to the events, is all exactly going in the other direction. People see this and think, you're not a very nice bunch of people. I thought that you were innocent victims, but you seem actually really aggressive and really unpleasant, and I don't really like you a lot, which is exactly the opposite of what Israel should be doing. And it's exactly the opposite what you should want if you care about actual anti-Semitism. It's the opposite of what you should want if you care about actually healing the world, coming together, bringing the world closer.
So one of my favorite segments in my newspaper is basically a part where they publish an article from 100 years ago, right? They're like, oh, so this was published 100 years ago. And a few years ago, this was even more exciting because it was during World War One. You could kind of see, oh, that's interesting how they reported about it 100 years ago, how they reported on it during World War One. So from that, I've picked up this habit of once in a while looking back of how we talked about things a year ago, or sometimes 2 years ago. And one of these things is obviously the situation in Israel and Gaza and surrounding October 7th. And we recorded three episodes, basically the 3 weeks following it. And a lot of what you just said was already in there, that hey, if Israel, like, the correct way for Israel to respond to this now is try to heal, is obviously it needs to be some form of response. Israel will respond for sure. Okay, how much sense does it make to try to take out the basically rocket launchers within Gaza? Obviously, like, the border needs to be closed, and the hostages need to be returned somehow, right? But exactly what you said, we already said 1 year ago, right? You are now in a position of weakness, as you perceive it, but internationally you're in a position of strength. Everyone is with you right now. There were very few countries that really said, Israel had it coming for them. No, right? Within the Middle East, there was solidarity with Israel. So we had this really comfortable position to act from. And then we kind of said, right, leading up to the ground invasion of Israel, we said, don't do it. It will be so detrimental to everything you're trying to achieve. Then Israel started doing it, and our conversation then suddenly revolved around, the actions that are taking place in Gaza are being called a genocide by one side of the spectrum. And both of us like to be very careful with these terms, because nowadays they're used a lot to emotionalize discussions, and it's very difficult to pin them down. You need a lot of context for them, and not enough context exists.
It's essentially weaponizing terms that should be treated very carefully, including just like pogroms, by the way. So things like pogroms, genocide, ethnic cleansing are terms that are way too serious to weaponize for political discourse.
Absolutely. However, 1 year later, we look at the situation in Gaza, and we look at the news items coming out of this, that basically now people in Gaza are no longer, like, there's no longer a plan for them to return to the north. The north of Gaza has basically been completely destroyed. The conversation that we have now is a completely different conversation from the one that we had a year ago, because the situation has changed, right? The analysis, I would say, kind of remains similar. But the situation has changed to the extent that, I mean, one of the terms that I don't like being used in public discourse actually comes up for me personally. And that's one of is ethnic cleansing taking place in the north of Gaza? And I am more and more coming to the conclusion that in the last few weeks and last few months, we see the government of Israel more and more enacting policies that go directly into that direction. But that is very difficult from the conversation that we had 1 year ago, and also very different from the situation we had 1 year ago.
Yeah, and so some people listening to this might say, hey, haven't you been paying attention to what happened 6 months ago, 8 months ago, 10 months ago? Wasn't that ethnic cleansing as well? Why do you say that all of a sudden it is now a thing, but it wasn't 8 months ago? Because at least the answer to that is that at least 8 months ago, the Israeli government could argue that even though their policies were destructive, they were in reaction to getting Hamas. They were in reaction to defeating the people who actually attacked them on October. Now, we already argued at the time that this was absolutely the wrong type of approach by Israel. It was destructive, led to 45, maybe by now 50,000 people dying among Palestinians, mostly civilians, mostly children. And so it may have been a wrong policy, but the focus was still on fighting Hamas. But what you see during the year slowly, and it's difficult to put an exact point at where it changed, but slowly it becomes more blatantly actually about getting rid of Palestinians. And it has less to do with actually getting any kidnapped people back. And it's getting less to do with actually defeating the group that attacked Israel in October last year. And I think that is important to realize that a year ago, the analysis was probably still correct to say, look, right now Israel is in a dark place. They're doing really destructive things, but their focus is not about on ethnic cleansing. Their focus is not on anything that their critics are accusing them of. What you see that unfortunately over the past year, the extreme elements within the Israeli government have taken more and more control of policy. And they are now using this horrific situation to achieve their wildest dreams, right? Because we know that there's always been a hardcore group of conservative, orthodox dreamers of greater Israel who basically see Israel free from their perspective, freed of Arabs. Basically, Israel for just Jewish Israelis, and no one else has a place there.
Absolutely. And so we're having this conversation right now. I'm not sure how much this conversation is happening in the public eye. At least I'm not reading a lot about it. I also think that we to a large extent, we have moved on from this conflict, right? It's just, it's very similar to what happened with Russia, Ukraine. At some point, we get used to the violence, we get used to the conflicts. There's a new government falling down every weekend by now, referring to last week's episode, or there's the US elections. We're very busy. And I'm not sure whether this conversation is taking place, certainly within the public eye, so within the media. But it also seems like that this conversation is not taking place within Western policymakers. So particularly within the usual suspects when we talk about the Western bubble, the United States, Germany, the United Kingdom, the UK. Because you would think that as the reality on the ground changes, and you, at least I'm not comfortable with my government's position on this current conflict, you would think that the governments also changed their position, but that's not happening, right? They're still very much with Israel from 1 year ago.
And I think some of this goes back to the conversation we just had about Amsterdam. So there is an incredibly powerful psychology when it comes to anti-Semitism, right? By the way, before listeners confuse this, psychology is different from lobby. Too many people always talk about Jewish lobby. The Jewish lobby is nowhere near as important as people make it out to be. In the United States, it's mostly the evangelical lobby that has an impact here rather than the Jewish lobby. But there is this deep psychology which is directly related to a guilt complex. I'm convinced that my country still needs to go through some kind of conversations about how it was partially responsible for the Holocaust itself, because they very happily, at least the Dutch government apparatus, very happily cooperated with the German occupiers to send Jewish people to Auschwitz and elsewhere. And the Netherlands has never had a conversation about itself and its own role during the Second World War. There is this very deep psychological aspect that makes it almost impossible for these countries you mentioned to step away from their fear of anti-Semitism, to step away from the analysis of what is actually, oh, if we now criticize Israel, does that make us anti-Semitic? The rational answer is no. Criticizing Israel is not in itself an anti-Semitic act, but the German, the Dutch, the British, the Americans find that step very, very difficult to take. On top of that, they are also co-conspirators, because they were the people who in November, December, January, basically gave a free card to the Netanyahu government. Hey, we have your back. Do whatever you like. You want to go in? You want to bomb Gaza? You want to kill tens of thousands of Palestinians? We understand you. You're defending yourself as a free democracy against evil terrorists. And, you know, to make an omelette, a few eggs need to be broken. That was their approach early on. And now it's very difficult for those same people to go back and say, hey, you know what, we were actually really wrong, and we're complicit in the death and in the ethnic cleansing that we're observing right now.
I think another element is that, particularly in the last 3 months, the West has seen Israel as way too useful for its own agenda. Because in the last 3 months, we mostly talked about Lebanon and about Hezbollah. The reaction here, at least in public media and in conversations, has never been, oh, the Israelis are taking into, they're way too risky with civilian casualties for taking out Hamas. It was always like, we're not so opposed to Hamas being, to Hezbollah being taken out, right? It's actually, you know, we really don't mind this. And I think that was the focus of the conversation the last 3 months. And in the meantime, Israeli policy in Gaza changed. And I think that switch hasn't really taken place within Western policymakers' minds, on top of what you just said.
I completely follow what you said with respect to two aspects. The first is that, of course, there's a comfort level, just, again, that psychology that exists within governments, but also in mainstream media, about attacking Hezbollah. Hey, that seems like a good thing. We don't like Hezbollah. Let's get rid of them. That's absolutely true. And the second bit is absolutely correct, that it completely shifted any attention away of these events in Palestinian territories. Absolutely. The one thing where I have my doubts is about to what extent Western governments actually care that much or believe that the fight against Hezbollah is useful to them. I think in many ways it's seen as a good cover, But I think that most analysis in the capitals, in London, in The Hague and elsewhere, is very much along the lines of actually in the long term, this is probably going to be bad. In the long term, the consequences are going to be negative because this will only perpetuate the violence in the long term. This will probably actually make Iran more popular. So I think most analysis by those European governments that don't have the emotional state of mind that Israel has at the moment, because Israel is just in this dark bunker place mentality, and it sees only good and evil. I think in European capitals, where they can take a little bit of a step back, there is a concern about the long-term consequences of what Israel is doing. But they can't call Israel out on it for the reasons we just mentioned.
Which are those European capitals? Because when you say this, I immediately think of the ones who have been very critical of Israel in the last few months. So Spain and Ireland, who have been very outspoken against Israeli actions. I mean, there's clear cultural differences, right? When we've analyzed this in the past, between your traditional Northwestern Europe versus then Europe as a whole. And I think those two countries kind of fall out of that. But are there any others that maybe have this analysis?
No. So my argument is that analysis exists even in Berlin. I mean, I'm not expert on Berlin, even in The Hague and even in London, but it's not something that obviously they would put out there. But there, you know, it's not as if the analysts, the intelligence agencies, the strategists within the German government, within the Dutch government, within the British government are idiots and they can't see the long-term consequences of what's happening. They can't politically put it out there because that would go against Israel and that would go against their narrative, whereas Spain and Ireland, as you've mentioned, are much more comfortable publicly stating it because they've been on that side all along, really, right? Since the very beginning, they've taken a more neutral approach and a more calm approach to the events. My argument is that I think for any analyst worth their name, it is completely obvious that the long-term consequences of the violence in Lebanon and in Palestine are not good news for the West. They are actually probably good news for Iran. Yes, Iran has a short-term problem, but in the long run, Iran will be seen as a principled actor by a lot of people who are already anti-Semitic, already anti-Israeli, and it will give Iran an awful lot of support. I think that most European governments are aware of this. It's just that they cannot admit it, except for the ones that you mentioned, such as Ireland and Spain.
So let's put the pin in the Western bubble. Why can't they admit it?
Because of the reasons I mentioned previously, namely that, first of all, they're complicit in the actual violence that started last year. They supported it. They were part of it in many ways, at least diplomatically. And secondly, they find it almost impossible to be critical of Israel because of the fear of being seen as anti-Semitic, because of the fear of being seen as not on the right side of history, not having learned the lessons from the Second World War and that kind of thing, which of course, and you know, someone who, an alien from outside would come in and say, hang on, aren't the lessons from the Second World War that you just shouldn't murder people, that you shouldn't kill people? Isn't that the lesson to be learned? But no, for the Dutch and German and British governments, the lesson is we need to protect Israel and Jewish people no matter what.
This seems like a great moment to end today's conversation on, we've been through quite some topics on the new Trump cabinet, on the situation in Amsterdam, and then Gaza 1 year later. If you have any questions, comments, or you heard a mistake that we've made throughout the episode, please make sure to send us an email to thewesternbubble@gmail.com, and we will try to incorporate them in our following episodes, particularly when it is on topics like these, right? We're very much looking forward to your feedback, as always. Thank you very much for being with us today. Make sure to join us again next week when we burst the Western bubble. That is it from my side. Balder, which closing quote did you pick for us today?
I chose a quote from Carl Jung, who I'm sure doesn't need any introduction, and he wrote, "People will do anything, no matter how absurd, in order to avoid facing their own souls. One does not become enlightened by imagining figures of light, but by making the darkness conscious."